I think we can manage with that. Today we're going to talk about the Gospel of Luke. And in the handout on one side, you've got kind of a summary of Luke taken from a foreword in a Bible that I have. It's the NAS, New American Standard, has a summary like this at the front of each of the books of the Bible. And so we're going to talk about some of the things in there later on. And on the back side is an assignment for next week. Y'all had so much fun with the one finding names. We'll work with another puzzle. And I'll explain about colophons in a few minutes. We're going to talk about those next week. But I wanted to give you a chance to read about it beforehand so you can kind of be up on it. Luke's Gospel is rather unique among the Gospels. It's probably the most elegant of the Gospels, has the best Greek. He was a doctor and well-educated, and so of all of the Gospels, he could write in Greek, and it didn't have to be translated. And so some of the other Gospels were apparently written in Aramaic or Hebrew, had to be translated, and always you lose a little bit in translation, and so they're not quite as straightforward as Luke's. So Luke probably wrote his in Greek, and it's the longest, most complete gospel, I think, and so it has a number of aspects of it that make it interesting, and one of the most interesting things about it is that we can know when it was written, and that turns out to be really important next week when we're going to talk about when all of these Gospels were written. That's the key, because if we can show that they were written in the first century, and as we've already gone over, they were documented, there were some structure in the book that indicates that it was a primary copy, and so the evidence that we're going to try to show is that all of these four Gospels were first-century manuscripts. That pretty well defeats the assumption of the critic. Remember, we started out talking about that the Gospels were hearsay from the 3rd or 4th century and assembled by a committee of Christians who were biased in their understanding of what was going on. But that's not the case. That's clearly not the case if these four Gospels in Codex W are first century manuscripts. All right, Luke. When you come to compare the four Gospels, they all tell the same story. I mean, we assume they do, don't we? And people latch on to what they think are slight discrepancies between the different accounts. And actually, if you read Burton Kaufman or a good commentary, you'll find that those what appear to be slight differences are easily explained. But when the four Gospels are compared, three of them appear to be very similar, don't they? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And John is quite different, and people wondered, well, why? And we'll talk about John's Gospel, and I think that comes up in 2 weeks. And so here, the synoptic Gospels are the three that are very similar. John's is a take on the meaning of the Gospels more than he talks about the miracles, and he talks about things that aren't covered in detail in the Synoptic Gospels. So, the fact that the three Gospels are similar leads critics to look at them and say, okay, Mark wrote his Gospel first, and then Matthew copied a lot of what Mark had written, and then Luke looked at both of them and wrote his Gospel, and they're sort of copying each other's work. Clearly, these men talk to one another, no doubt about it. And when it comes to Luke, he interviewed the eyewitnesses, didn't he? And we'll talk about that in a minute. If you look at these four men, you see their names here. What does that diagram represent to you? Who's the closest to Jesus? It's John, isn't it? John was the... These men are represented in the Bible in terms of verses that you can read. John was the one that Jesus, what? Loved. Didn't Jesus love all of his apostles and all of his disciples? And does he love all of us? Why, in what sense is John the beloved? Any of you wonder about that? Pardon me? It, like a best friend, okay. And certainly, if you look at the men as they were chosen. John is the younger brother of James. James was the one who probably fit the idea of a student of a rabbi. He was the right age and everything. John was probably the youngest of all of the apostles. Most of them were 15, 16 years old, essentially entering graduate school. And here's John, who's maybe 12. And so he's still kind of immature. And Jesus kind of took him under his wing. And really, John and Jesus were close. That's sort of theoretical. We aren't given that in great detail. But that appears to be the case. James and John, their mother, father, followed them with Jesus as they traveled about, and she was probably concerned about her youngest there. Well, these all have hints about these men. Now, the authors of the Gospels are not named in the Gospels as the author, except in the case of Luke, who claims to write this after having done a lot of research. But we surmise that John was the one that wrote John, and that Matthew wrote Matthew, and Mark wrote Mark. Because of the content, we can tell things that are said about them as to who they are. But in John 21:7, the disciple whom Jesus loved, Matthew 9 and 10, we see Matthew having been chosen by Jesus he was standing at the collection booth collecting taxes, and Jesus simply said, "Come follow me," and he dropped everything and followed him. And apparently the next day he threw a big dinner for Jesus and the other apostles, and that's mentioned here, having dinner at Matthew's house. Acts 6 and 7, a verse that the preacher mentioned this morning in his sermon. A large number of the priests were converted to Christianity, and it's mentioned there. That has to do with Mark. Mark apparently was a Levite, and we talked about that early on, that he left the Jewish faith and followed Jesus. He went with Paul, and later on he was in a number of other missionary programs, traveled around the Mediterranean Sea. And so he was a more distant member. He probably was not a follower of Jesus when Jesus was alive, but was converted soon afterwards. And Ken mentioned, as a priest, he knew what had happened to the curtain in the temple when Jesus died. And then finally, Luke's on the outside. Luke comes along later on, travels with Paul on his latter missionary journeys. Paul had some health problems. Paul was injured a couple of times. He was in a shipwreck. And Luke just traveled along with him, took care of him. Probably the care of Luke was providentially provided by God, no doubt. But nonetheless, he learned most of what he knew from the eyewitnesses who lived and walked with Jesus, but he was not one of them. So you see, he's a bit more distant. And so that's what this diagram represents. We've got four views of the life of Jesus from different perspectives. And you can see that simply in how close they were to the Lord. Now, by comparing authors, we find a continuous sequence from the one closest to Jesus, the beloved Apostle John, to Matthew, who was an apostle but not in the inner circle. Who were in the inner circle, incidentally, of Jesus' apostles? Peter, James, and John. And often they're taken aside on special occasions, and we see them as being the closest to Jesus. Well, Matthew's not in that inner circle. And Mark, a converted priest, and finally to Luke, a Gentile physician. Now, that's kind of unusual that we have a Gentile writing about Jesus. The other three are Jewish. And his perspective is obviously going to be even more important to the Gentile world, because if he's convinced about the life of Christ and who he was, that's going to mean a whole lot to the people that they're trying to teach when they take the gospel to the whole world. As a trained physician, Luke was adept at taking notes. I don't know if any of you have ever thought about medical school. A few of you may have gone through medical school. I don't know. I thought about it and decided to deal with people when they're healthy is difficult enough. To deal with them when they're sick is going to be even worse. So I chose to do research rather than work with individuals. But here, Luke is a physician. He can interview people, take notes, organize the material, create a diagnosis of the situation. He knew all of the cures that were available at the time, or those that things that might help a patient with this or that disease. And so he was well versed in organizing material. And his classical Greek is the very best in the New Testament. We're going to talk about the Old Testament because it wasn't written in Greek, was it? It was written in Hebrew and Aramaic. But in the New Testament, he has the best organization, the best language use, choice of words, and you can pick him out from other writers by things like that. And that's been done many, many times by many scholars. As an educated Gentile, his conviction that the life and resurrection of Jesus were factual. So now you can talk about that. That sound. Remember the reaction that when Paul was preaching to the Greeks or to the Romans, it was the Greeks, and they were very skeptical about the resurrection when he appeared to them in Athens. And so to have someone like Luke write this out would be very persuasive to the Gentile world. So here's Luke's introduction. And it tells us a whole lot about his gospel. It tells us how he did it. And it's an amazing paragraph here. You look at it and you analyze it and you look at the choice of words and how they're fit together, and you get a view of his mind and how it works. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about the life of Christ. That's what he's going to write about. How many many have undertaken to do this. What does that imply? A lot of them had thought about it, and some of them had put some stuff to paper, but it was a difficult task. Not very many had succeeded in doing this. And there may be other Gospels, okay? You can't deny the fact that others had written about the life of Jesus. But they weren't. We don't have their manuscripts. God didn't preserve them for us, carry them forward to us. But things that have been fulfilled among us, and I think he's talking about people. We don't know if, in general, we don't know if he had been in Jerusalem much. He must have visited there. We don't know where Paul met him particularly or where they got together. But it's whatever happened to Jesus was fulfilled. That's an implication, of course, about the Old Testament prophecies. And the messianic prophecies are important. Jesus was the person that God had intended to break upon the human scene at just this point in history, and when in the first century. Just as they were handed down to us by those who were from the first, were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. And so he's going to talk about eyewitness accounts. And you see key words here, handed down. People had talked about it and given these accounts and given records and that sort of thing. And these were the eyewitnesses, and he's implying he's not one of them. He's getting all of this information together from people who did walk with Christ, were servants of the word. I capitalized word here. It isn't capitalized in most accounts. But, of course, John opens his gospel saying that the Word was God. And he's talking about Christ. And so that's an interpretation, of course. But servants of the Word, and I think of the apostles there. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated. Think about that word. He spent a lot of time trying to put all of this together, interviewing people, thinking about what they said. He wrote all this down. He put it all together in some form. Everything from the beginning. It seemed good also to me to write an orderly account. So his account is one that's put pretty much in chronological order, in importance, and arranged everything according to what was said as it related to a particular miracle or an event in Jesus' life. And so he assembled all of this. For you, most excellent Theophilus. Theophilus is a Greek name, of course, and it says, it means what? Philos is one of the forms of love, isn't it? And Theos is God, lover of God. And we don't know if that's a real person. It could have been. Or if it's sort of a general name for people who love God. So that you may know the certainty. That's important too, isn't it? You may know, you may be absolutely assured of what the story is. And you've heard it, you've been taught it, but now I'm going to write it all out. And so a lot of the early preaching and the spread of the gospel in the first century was from Paul and Peter and others who had traveled about telling these stories and teaching these accounts to people. But now he's going to put it all down permanently in written form so anybody can read it. Do you ever think about writing things out? you can tell somebody what you want to have happen to all of your belongings after you die. And that's word of mouth. But it doesn't mean a whole lot until you do what? Write it down. Write it down and put it on paper. And then it becomes something that can be pursued and accomplished. All right. Here is Luke's presentation on the left. This is just a random page out of his gospel. On the right, we have Mark's gospel. And do you see any differences in them? What about the writing? Do you think maybe it's the same scribe who is writing this out, lettering these terms, putting it all together? There are some distinctions. In Luke's account, notice the frequency over here with which he sort of, it's the opposite of an indentation. It's, I guess you call it an accentation. I don't know if you do or not. But anyway, he moves the start of a new thought out into the margin. And he has some spacing in here. Notice he's not trying to use the page up efficiently as opposed to Mark, who goes line after line after line after line, and occasionally there's a small break here and here. So the style of the writing is a little different. Luke has a feel for organizing his material, and in essence, he's paragraphing the material that the other writers don't do. And that partly comes from the fact that Luke writes this out in Greek to start with. And the other three Gospels are translations from another language into Greek. And so the scribe has done the translation and reads it back to them, and they approve it. But here you probably have his original organization of the material. We're going to look at Luke 1, verses, here we have on this page 22 to 33, we're going to start with verse 26 in a minute. When you get a page like this, you see it's organized just like the one we saw before with beginning material out here in the edge and spacing in the material. This is a different page. But this is near the start. Now, we'll add in the verses in red. And so you can see that what we're starting with up here is verse 22. It runs down. We're going to begin here with verse 26 and run through the rest of the page in some detail. And we're going to put the translation over here. So, there we have. Excuse me. There we have, beginning in verse 26, and I should have had a written form on the podium here. It says, now in the sixth month was sent the angel Gabriel from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth. And that's not the word order we would put it in. We'd say God sent the angel, and he puts it in the form, the appropriate Greek form of the message. And so we can find those words over here if you look carefully. For example, the word Nazareth. If I can see it here. Uh-oh, there we go. Okay, here's verse 26. See if we can find Nazareth here. We've been in the process of looking for these names, and I think it's somewhere along in here. I can't read it easily enough at this magnification. If it had it in front of me, I could do it. Well, we'll just go through the story here. He was sent to a virgin. Betrothed, that's right, to a man named Joseph of the house of David, and the name of the virgin was Mary. And so you can find Mary's name over here, right here. Maria, or Miriam is how that comes out in the Greek. And entering to her, he said, "Hail, the favored one, the Lord is with you." And she at the saying was disturbed and considered what might be this greeting. See, we wouldn't say it exactly that way, and that's not how it's going to show up in your Bible, but I'm giving you a word for word translation. So what does it mean? And so and said the angel to her, "Fear not," which is a standard greeting of angels, because apparently when an angel appears to you, you'll be afraid. I don't know what is there that's fearsome about the appearance of an angel. Do you ever think about that? Huh? I haven't seen one before. It's something we haven't seen, and most unusual. I suspect that the angels are rather imposing if you meet one. Especially Gabriel must be, because that's usually the response that people have. "Fear not, Mary, for you did find favor with God." And of course, when you're looking over here, when you see a word like God, then you can find over here a word with a line above it, which represents him. And so you can kind of follow your way along through the text here. And behold, you will conceive in the womb and have a son, and you shall call his name, the name of him, Jesus. And he will be great, Son of the Most High. It's kind of interesting that this represents God, but it isn't abbreviated over here at all. It's spelled out. And he will give him, that is God, will give him, the Lord God will give him the throne of David, his father. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And so IAKOB is over here and on the bottom line somewhere. Here is an intimate conversation between an angel and a woman. Who else is present? We don't have anybody listed, do we, as being there. It seems to be a very, very private conversation. Okay, yes? Well, how did Luke know about that conversation? In his opening chapter, his opening paragraph, he told you how he learned about what he wrote. What did he do? How did he know of the conversation between the angel Gabriel and Mary? And so the answer, of course, Luke had interviewed Mary in preparing his gospel. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Well, where does inspiration come into play in such an interchange? Well, Mary has to remember what happened accurately, doesn't she? And do you think Mary had the kind of a mind that would memorize a conversation like this? Yes, I think she did. Luke 2:19, Mary treasured all of these things and pondered them in her heart. What does that mean? She thought about it, didn't she? She thought about it extensively. And so she remembered everything that the angel had said, or that was going on in connection with the birth of Jesus. She remembered all of the details. She had a mind. This Luke 2:51, same sort of thing. She treasured all these things in her heart. same sort of thing about the interchange between Jesus and the priest in the temple when he was 12 years old, and he was answering questions and asking questions. And when she learned about that, evidently he told her everything, and she treasured these events. The Jews had a mind for memory work. In fact, Middle East people do in general. The studies that they go through in what we would call grade school consist in large part of memorizing. And so they learn to do this sort of thing. And so Mary is now an old woman. She was 15 or 16 when Jesus was born, and he lived to be, 33 or so. And so at his death, she was of an age of about 48 or 50. And by the time Luke gets around to interviewing her, she's probably in her 70s, maybe early 80s. Well, we know the time when this interviewing took place in the late 50s. And so if she was, you can figure that out. If she was 15 in 4 B.C. when Jesus was born, how old is she in A.D. 50? Well, she's something like 65. So she remembers all of these things and tells Luke about them. The question comes down to, when was Luke's gospel written? We're gonna talk about indications of the time that the gospels were written, and if we get a match in this situation, we would assume that we understand some of the information that's recorded at the end of each gospel as to who the scribe was and when he was doing the writing. So it was written when Paul was taken prisoner in Jerusalem. He was transferred to Caesarea, where he came to trial under Felix. Luke accompanied him and attended to his needs. And so he's going to be in prison there for 2 years. At the same time, Felix was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked to him. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So he's there for at least 2 years. And Luke is attending to his needs, but that doesn't require 24-hour-a-day supervision. And he was free in those 2 years to travel throughout Israel and gather information for the gospel. Most people would agree that that's when he did it, before he had been traveling. Of course, he had gained a lot of information from Paul about the life of Christ. Was Paul an eyewitness of Jesus' life? Not directly, was he? Paul was a student of another rabbi named Gamaliel in Jerusalem, and they probably talked about what Jesus had done, mostly from a negative viewpoint. And when Christianity began to flourish, Paul was an enemy at first, wasn't he? But he was a witness. He knew what had happened to Jesus. And so as he preached, Paul preached Christ throughout the world. Everywhere he went was the very, very most successful missionary of Christianity. And so Luke heard all of this. But he's going back and he's reinvestigating all of the details, you see. So he interviews Mary, and he goes and interviews some other people too. As you go through this early chapters of Luke, you find him talking about the events when an angel visited Zacharias at the birth of John the Baptist. And some detail there that you wonder, well, how would he know about that? Because Zacharias and his wife are long gone. They were old people at the time when John the Baptist was born. But they have family. And, of course, there may be people, other priests. And, of course, Mark was a priest. And Mark would have known about everything that Zacharias had encountered at the birth of John the Baptist. Plus, Mary went to visit Elizabeth for 3 months. Remember that? When Elizabeth was in her 6th month, Mary went to visit with her before John the Baptist was born and spent 3 months with her. What do you suppose they talked about? Well, all sorts of things, and that could well include what Zacharias had told Elizabeth about what happened. That's described when the angel appeared to Zacharias in the temple when he was burning incense. So you can kind of get a feel for what Luke's doing here. He's interviewing critical. He's had an outline of what's going on here, and so he's looking at the details and going back and checking from the individuals who actually lived through the experience, and then writing all of this down and organizing it into a book. Now, Luke's introduction here says he's writing, and who's he writing to? He's writing to Theophilus. Well, in Acts, the first chapter, he has a similar kind of introduction, and he says, in my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do. What book was that? It's got to be the book of Luke. I mean, that's what Luke's all about. And this says, since he labels Luke as a former book, Luke has to be written before Acts was written. You follow me there? And Acts was written in the period A.D. 60 to 62, or maybe 63, while Paul was in prison in Rome. And Acts recounts all of that story about how they traveled by ship after Paul appealed to Caesar. He was taken to Rome. They were shipwrecked, rescued, eventually made it to Rome. And then the story, as Luke records the last few chapters of Acts, tells about how Paul taught those who in Rome who were his guardians in the prison, people that came to him. He continued to preach even as a prisoner and for a couple of years. But it doesn't tell us how it turned out. We don't know exactly what happened to Paul when finally his case was decided. When he appeared before Caesar, we don't know in his appeal if he was exonerated and turned loose, which is a possibility, or if he was convicted and beheaded. And so there's an uncertainty about the ending of it. And that says that the writing of Acts ended in the early 60s. And since Luke was written before then we can be pretty sure that Luke was written sometime around A.D. 60, 61. Since Acts was written in 62 or 63. And if you go in your Bible and look for the time of its writing, you can't find specific dates like this for the other Gospels, but you can for Luke because of all of the detail that he put into his Gospel. So, Acts was written in 62 or 63. Luke can therefore be dated to 60, 61. It's the only Gospel whose date of composition is known, within a year or two. We will use this fact to determine how to interpret the symbols at the end of each gospel. And I've given you that on the back of your handout. And this is what it looks like. This is called a colophon. And so here's Luke's gospel ends here. And then there's this strange diagram here with a bird in the middle of it. It looks almost out of place, doesn't it? Is that a chicken or an eagle or a sparrow or what kind of a bird? And the bird has a very long tail, okay? And it has a bunch of lines above it and some lines below it. And there's one of these at the end of each gospel. If you go look at Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Alexandricus, you'll find these there too. There are symbols placed at the ends of the gospels, seem to have nothing to do with whatever's written in the gospel. But it's a common thing that's been handed down historically to modern times, and that the colophon is a modern term that's placed in modern books. The colophon is placed on the backside of the title page, and it is a straightforward. It's just simply a listing of who the printer was, and when the book was printed, and how many copies were printed, and the address of the printer, the details about the printing of that book. In older times, it was placed at the end of the book instead of at the beginning. And some of them are very decorative. But with the invention of printing, the colophon became a straightforward sort of thing, a listing of the details about the publishing of the book. But before that, and here's 2,000 years ago, the colophon evidently had that same kind of information in it, but it was put in diagrammatic form, because we're looking at a bunch of different languages. So the colophon consists of material that probably tells us who the scribe was, when the copy was made, maybe how many copies were made, and when the original document was made. And so we're going to look at that next week, and I've given you a hint about how to interpret this as a date in Roman history, because all of the dates, government official dates in Roman history, were written in terms of something called AUC, a Roman term that dates everything from the founding of the city of Rome. So that's the explanation at the bottom of that page, and the top gives you Luke's colophon. Now, if we can read, know that it was written, say, around AD 60, and you interpret the colophon and it gives you a date of AD 60, then you know you've got a good handle on how to interpret the colophon. We aren't given any directions anywhere, as far as I can find, about what these colophon symbols meant. So, puzzle about that a little bit. Dream about it a few times this week. And next week we'll go through there and see if it makes any sense. Okay, we're gonna look at Luke again next week, and that in terms of that, as well as the other gospels as well. Thank you for your attention.